Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast, which will be available on YouTube, iTunes, and also on Podbean. So there's three ways to listen to our podcast, which will also be uploaded onto the Jazz Flashes website at jazzflashes.blogspot.com. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and this time I'm not talking to you from Tennessee. I'm talking to you from Pittsboro, North Carolina, where I'm spending a few days with my wife and her family, and our daughter as well, here in the beautiful hills of North Carolina. And we're going to be doing a special, very special edition of this show today, because my friend Malcolm McFarlane has agreed to join us over the waves here, and I mean over the waves, both the radio waves and the ocean waves, because he's joining us from his home in England. Hello, Malcolm. Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, Anton.
How are you doing this morning? Afternoon for you?
Yeah, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon over here, and it's been a cold morning, but it's warm up this afternoon, and it's a bit dull, but it's acceptable.
Pretty much the same around here, and any time is a good time to talk about our favorite singer, a man of many faces, a man of many talents, Mr. Bing Crosby. I'd like to start by mentioning that Malcolm is the British editor of the Bing magazine, which is the magazine of the International Club Crosby, and yours truly is the American counterpart, the American co-editor of the magazine. But Malcolm has written several really interesting books that I really recommend to everyone out there. One of them is a biography of Perry Como. The other one is a biography of the great Rosemary Clooney called Late Life Jazz, and that's one that I have read, and it's really a fantastic book, very, very recommendable if you enjoy jazz and Rosemary Clooney. And, of course, the great, I don't know if I could say this or not, but the Bible of Bing Crosby books and the way of talking about the life of Bing Crosby is this monumental book called Bing Crosby Day by Day, which pretty much tells us everything that, or more or less everything that Bing Crosby did throughout his very interesting life. And it's now available, Malcolm, am I wrong about this or not? It's available online on the ICC International Club Crosby website.
The Bing Magazine website it's on.
The Bing Magazine, that's right.
Yeah, and Bing Crosby Day by Day. Click on that and you've got many, many items to look at.
Well, the topic of today's chat with Malcolm McFarlane is the career of Bing Crosby as a jazz singer. And these days we are getting to the end of 2016, and Christmas has been on us for several days. And, you know, we know of Bing Crosby, many people know of Bing Crosby primarily as a singer of Christmas songs, White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas, and all the big hits that he had throughout his career related to Christmas, recorded both for Decca and for other labels. But there's a lot more to Bing Crosby than just this side, which is very interesting, but there's a lot more to him than this side of him as a singer of Christmas songs. And you were telling me before we began the recording that Bing Crosby as a jazz singer is such a wide-ranging topic because it goes back to the very beginning of his career. And that beginning of his career, Malcolm, has to do with another giant name in American music, Mr. Paul Whiteman.
Indeed.
If we think about the music of Bing Crosby in those early years, the records he made with Paul Whiteman, the records we made with he made with the Rhythm Boys within the Paul Whiteman organization, how much of a jazz element is there in those really early Bing Crosby records?
I think there's an awful lot there. Bing was influenced quite early on, going into the local shops in Spokane, Washington, listening to the early jazz records that were available, and that influenced him quite a lot. And when he got to, he had a little act with Al Rinker called Crosby and Rinker. He was discovered by Paul Whiteman. Paul Whiteman had another singer called Harry Barris and made them the Rhythm Boys. And the jazz influences started to come out quite early on. an early record, Mississippi Mud. Lots of ad libs, lots of scats, illustrates the point. You have to define what is a jazz singer, I suppose. And doing that Rosemary Clooney book, we tried to get to the bottom of it. And I remember one prominent jazz musician saying to me, "It's the kind of thing old men debate." Really, jazz singing, some of the singers say it's where you fight the melody. You don't follow the melody. You fight the melody, and you scat, you ad-lib, and like that. And certainly, if that's the definition, Bing Crosby was a jazz singer. Rosemary Clooney was not. She sang the melody, mm-hmm. but she sang with a lot of jazz musicians, which is why our book was called Late Life Jazz. But Crosby, early days, Mississippi Mud, as I say, a song called Changes, Big Spider Mick playing on that. Old Man River, a huge hit for Whiteman, with Bing singing a short vocal in the middle, but very jazz orientated, if you listen to it now. That's 1928. And then, of course, after he left Whiteman, having been influenced by Bix and Frankie Trumbo, people like that, he made a fantastic record with Duke Ellington in the early hours of one morning after they'd both been performing elsewhere, St. Louis Blues, and that's absolutely mind-blowing.
That's the classic W.C. Handy song, St. Louis Blues.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, a lot of people criticize Paul Whiteman because, you know, he billed himself as the king of jazz, and it's always hard, you know, the king of rock and roll, the king of swing, the king of everything. There should be a king for everything, right? But some people say, well, Paul Whiteman was not really a jazz musician. And while that may be true to a certain extent, the kinds of musicians that he chose to be in his band were always really hot jazz players, like you mentioned Big Spiderbeck and Frankie Trumbauer, and there's several more. What do you think of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra as a musical organization?
Oh, I think it was superb in its day, absolutely superb. It could play anything and play it magnificently. When he took on those jazz musicians in 1927, he changed the character of the orchestra quite a bit and added an awful lot to it, I felt.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he was a very good band leader, and he actually created a whole school of people who followed him back in those days. And he was extremely important in the early years of Bing Crosby's career, in that he was able to hear something in Bing that not everybody had heard up until that point. So when I listen to those old records, as outdated as they sometimes sound, because they were made almost 100 years ago, about 90 or so years ago, they're still very engaging records, many of them, several of the ones you mentioned. And it really, they really give us an idea of the of where Bing Crosby was going to go in just a few years. And it didn't take him very long, right? It was in the early 1930s. Was it around the early 1930s or so when he struck out on his own finally and started recording for Brunswick?
In 1930, he left Whiteman and signed for Brunswick, and then was with Brunswick till 1934.
That was those were the first records I ever heard by Bing Crosby. Actually, I don't remember the original releases of them, as you can imagine. But I remember watching Bing Crosby sing in the movies. First of all, probably Holiday Inn might have been the first movie I ever saw. At least the one that comes to mind now. But one of the very first records by Bing Crosby I ever heard was Please. And that one was the one that really showed to me or introduced me to the sound of Bing Crosby. Do you remember what the first record by Bing you ever heard was?
Oh, my word. Oh, well, the family joke is White Christmas. They say when I was a baby, I wouldn't go to sleep. I was born in 1942, the year Holiday Inn came out, White Christmas came out.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't go to sleep. They'd put White Christmas on the record player, and I'd go to sleep. So that's the family joke. I don't know how true it is, I've no idea, but I'd have to say it was White Christmas. But my discovery of Bing Crosby was in my teenage years. In the UK, in the mid-50s, Bill Haley, Elvis Presley, G. Vincent, Jerry Lee Lewis, you couldn't hear them on the BBC. You had to listen to a commercial station called Radio Luxembourg, which broadcast from Europe, and you had to listen to it at night on the medium wave, and the signal would fade. But it was the thing to listen to for us teenagers. And amongst all the rock and roll, there was a 15-minute program called Bing Sings. And it was introduced by the song If You Should Ever Need Me, I'll Be Here, a 1931 song. And they played, it was a 15-minute program, they played various bits and pieces. And it went in like osmosis, I suppose, over the weeks. And I realised this guy could sing anything. And I started to like it. And at the time, I was a fan of Martin and Lewis, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Mm-hmm. I went to the cinema to see them in their latest film, the name of which I now forget. But the film on with it was a Crosby film called Blue Skies. And that, I thought, was fantastic. And I became a committed Crosby fan from that moment on. And I could bore you for hours how it developed and so on. But that was what changed my influences.
You're listening to the Jazz Flashes podcast with Anton Garcia Fernandez right here in North Carolina. Welcome. And over in England, we have Malcolm McFarlane. And we're talking about Bing Crosby as a jazz singer. Now, Malcolm, this has been talked about and discussed very often, but the style of Bing Crosby had very much to do with the introduction and invention of the microphone. How important was the microphone to the sound of Bing Crosby in those early years?
Well, Gary Giddens points out that Bing was a baritone, and the microphone helped to bring out those tones rather than helping the tenors. So that's his view, which I don't know enough to comment, really. But it enabled Bing to sing in a more intimate manner. I mean, he could belt out the notes, as we know, in those days, but he used microphones a lot in the theatre and, again, changed the face of show business at the time through that use of the microphone.
And the singers that came before him, before the invention of the microphone, were mostly influenced by Al Jolson. Now, when I listened to Bing's early records, the ones from the early 1930s, maybe before he moved to Decca in the mid-1930s, I do hear quite a bit of a Al Jolson influence still in those early records. Would you agree with that?
I would. One song, High Water, I don't really know High Water, that strikes me very much like Jolson. Bing really belts it out in an emotional way. Yes, it's undoubtedly in there. I mean, we know as a teenager, Bing was influenced by Jolson. Jolson used to tour his shows, and when he went to Spokane, Bing used to get a job in the theatre helping out and to watch Jolson. So he saw him about two or three times when Jolson came through Spokane in those late 1915, 1917, 1919, those kind of years.
And they would later work together quite a bit, actually, when Al Jolson came back after that big Jolson movie, the Jolson Story hit, and it revived in his career in many ways. Still in the 1930s, Bing Crosby was making records for Brunswick, accompanied by some pretty nice jazz bands. One of that comes to mind is that of Lenny Hayton, who's not very well known necessarily these days, and nobody thinking about jazz will think of Lenny Hayton. But wow, that was a fantastic orchestra, and those arrangements for those early records of Bing Crosby for Brunswick were in many ways very jazzy. Plus, he got to record duets with the Mills Brothers.
Yes.
Which are among my favorite records of that era for Bing.
Absolutely. Dinah, a wonderful version of Bing scatting and ad-libbing and so on. Tremendous.
Now, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra gets credited with this very often, and Bing Crosby, I don't think nearly as much, but whereas Frank Sinatra was able in the 1950s, on his Capitol Records that he made, those concept albums that are now classics, and even before that, in the 1940s, he always got credited for understanding the lyric and trying to phrase the lyric in a certain way depending on the meaning of the lyric. But in my opinion, that although that is definitely true for Frank, I would say that's also true of Bing Crosby. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, certainly Bing's early records up to, say, I don't know, late 30s, very much so, I agree with you. After that, to be honest, he became a little more bland, mm-hmm. I felt, probably because of the influence of Jack Capp. And Sinatra really put his heart and soul into the lyrics of a song, where Bing held back a bit. You have to admit that, really.
Yeah, well, what I was trying to see or show is maybe a continuum or a connection between the two in that way, in that, you know, this is not something that Frank necessarily invented out of nowhere, or, you know, this is something that other singers, and particularly Bing Crosby before him, were also doing, I think. And sometimes it doesn't, I don't think it gets said very often when it comes to Bing.
No, Bing's early records, which Frank would have been influenced by, packed with emotion and plucks your heartstrings and so on. Oh, yeah, undoubtedly. I just think that in later years, he pulled back a little bit from showing his feelings. But some of those emotional things he was doing in his Brunswick years, tremendous. And those are the ones that Frank was listening to. Frank went to see Bing in 1933 and then decided he wanted to be a singer.
Now, in 1934, Bing Crosby changed labels.
Yes.
And this is a really important point in his career, a really important change for Bing, I would say, for many reasons. He went from Brunswick to Decca Records, and he would stay with Decca for about two decades.
Yep.
How did the style of Bing Crosby change when he moved to Decca Records?
Well, Jack Capp had been the A&R man of Brunswick, and when he wanted to form a record company with Ted Lewis from the UK, they formed Decca, and the first records were in August 34. And it does seem that Jack Capp felt that commercially it would be far better to have a more restrained type of singing rather than the ad libs and boo-boo-boos and all the rest that Bing was doing. And you see that if you look through his records. Mind you, there's still some great songs. I mean, Someday Sweetheart, one of the first records he made, mm-hmm. For Decca, is packed with jazz and ad libs and so on. I'm an Old Cowhand, tremendous. You know, halfway through, he's talking to the musicians and ad-libbing. So they were still in there, but certainly commercially, Jack Capp found that Bing's ballads, sung straight, those were the ones that sold with the deep voice, because every man thought he could sing like Bing. And that's Jack Capp stuck to that commercial. He cut out the intros, the verses, which Bing particularly liked.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Capp didn't think they were worthwhile commercially, so he cut them out. White Christmas, of course, being the most famous one, which Irving Berlin, to be fair, cut out beforehand. But great songs, Walking the Floor Over You.
That's an Ernest Stubbs song, Walking the Floor Over You, which tells you that Bing Crosby, in his Decca years, he pretty much diversified his style quite a bit, because he was singing all different kinds of music. He wasn't just singing jazz or pop, but he was making pop versions of country songs like Pistol Packing Mama or Walking the Floor Over You. He was doing Hawaiian numbers. He was doing Latin numbers.
Irish.
Right? So in many ways, Bing became the multimedia star that he became in those years, in many ways through diversity, through not pigeonholing his style in just one way, but trying to attract as many different listeners as he possibly could.
Well, and to be fair, Bing gave the credit for that to Jack Capp. He really didn't want to be singing some of those songs, but Jack Capp suggested he did, so he did, and the success was there for all to see. So, going back to jazz briefly, Bass the Street Blues, Bing Crosby and Connie Boswell. Mm-hmm. Some of the songs he did with Connie Boswell, absolutely superb. I was listening to Bass the Street Blues this morning, and it still blows me away now.
Well, Connie Boswell was a fantastic jazz singer. She, you know, the record she made with the Boswell sisters, which would in turn influence the Andrews sisters and many others, are just, I think, gems of 1930s jazz. And I don't think that is stressed enough, in my opinion, how good a singer Connie Boswell was. And even in the 50s when she made that album Connie that has been available on CD for a while now, well, she has always been, together with Lee Wiley, one of my favorites from that time period when it comes to female singers.
Yeah.
So you're
Lee
right.
Lee Wiley is not a name you hear very often nowadays, but she was a great jazz singer.
Now, even though Bing Crosby diversified his style in the beginning in the mid-1930s when he signed with Decca Records and was under Jack Capp, as you were mentioning, he still kept making some really good jazz or jazz influence records. The one you just mentioned with Connie Boswell is a very good example, and several others come to mind. What others would you just mention among your favorites from this time period when it comes to Bing Crosby doing jazz music?
Well, they put together a nice album of Bing's songs called Bing and the Dixieland Bands.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some Deep in the Heart of Texas, Goodbye, My Lover, Goodbye, Nobody's Sweetheart, songs like that, which I think they're great. I really do.
There's also this CD, Bing and Some Jazz Friends, right, from the Decca label.
Yeah.
And it's some novelty numbers with Louis Jordan, for example. My Socks Don't Match is one of them. And it's got some music with Jack Teagarden, with Woody Herman, even with his own brother, Bob Crosby, who was a good jazz band leader. The Bobcats, in my opinion, were a great Dixieland jazz band, and that's something else that is not stressed very often.
That's right.
So that is one that I've been listening to quite a bit in preparation for our chat, because it does include some great examples of Bing Crosby doing jazz for Decca Records throughout these two decades that he recorded for Decca. Now, one thing we can't forget to mention, Malcolm, is the association with one of Bing's closest and best friends throughout his life, who was the great Satchmo Louis Armstrong. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how this friendship came about, and we can maybe discuss some of the records they made together?
Well, back in the 1920s, Bing was a great, used to go and see Satchmo playing at various clubs, and Gary Giddens reckons that Bing's style changed because of Louis Armstrong. I don't know how true that is, but it certainly was a huge influence on him. I find it difficult to pick out songs that showed that influence, really. But yeah, he loved Satchmo from the early days. It's a pity they didn't make more records together. They made a few ones along the way, and then of course they did an album together in 1960, which I have a feeling they weren't both in the studio at the same time, because it doesn't have the kind of free-flowing ad-libs you'd expect. Mm-hmm. It's very polished and very pleasant, but the excitement is somehow lacking, I felt, in that album. But I like to play it still.
You mean Bing and Satchmo, right? That album from 1960. Yeah. I kind of agree with you. The ad-libbing is really not there. Everything sounds a little scripted, or quite a bit in many ways.
Yeah.
And that is too bad. Now, I wonder if the, one of the reasons why they didn't make more records together had to do with the time period, about Satchmo being African-American, being white, if a racial issue maybe had something to do with it. Not from the point of view of Bing, who was not, you know, who has very often, you know, we can say that Bing Crosby was one of these musicians in that era who helped integrate African-American and white musicians in many ways, because he was a big star and he was making records with Louis Armstrong, which was not the most common thing, you know, like Billie Holiday doing records with Artie Shaw, for example, or with Benny Goodman in those early years, or the Benny Goodman Trio and Quartet, which was a biracial outfit. Maybe that racial aspect had something to do with that.
It's possible. Bing made sure that Louis Armstrong was in the film Pennies from Heaven and recorded some of the songs from that with him. He also got him into Dr. Rhythm, but unfortunately the clip was cut from the film.
Mm-hmm.
So he really pushed Louis Armstrong strongly in those days. It is sad, really. I wouldn't have thought, perhaps it was, but the influences in the South were very strong and may well have affected Jack Capp's commercial judgment.
Actually, one of the very first songs by Bing and Louis that I ever heard was Gone Fishing.
Yes.
And I feel like whenever Bing and Satchmo got together, there was this camaraderie. There was also this feeling of we're here doing this because we want to have fun. And maybe for that reason, they recorded novelty numbers like that one, which I must admit, it's a very funny record.
Well, it comes from a radio show, and Louis was on Bing's radio show many times. After the war, he was only on Kraft Music Hall once, but after the war on Philco, Chesterfield, and he was on all the time. And they're wonderful shows, very freewheeling and relaxed, being at his best, Louis letting it go. And what's that song where Louis had a hit with the song and Bing's going to sing it, and he said he should be doing this, and they ad-lib all the way through,
Kiss to Build a Dream On.
That's it, Kiss to Build a Dream On, that's the one. It's absolutely hilarious.
And Jasmine Records over in the UK put out some CDs where one can find some examples of these duets that Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong did on the radio. And we'll talk about the radio in just a second. You're listening to the Jazz Flashes podcast with Anton Garcia Fernandez here in the United States, and over across the pond in the UK, Malcolm McFarlane, who's joining us today thanks to the wonders of new technology. And I can actually see him right here in front of me, and he looks great. And I'm having a great time talking about one of my favorite singers of all time, Mr. Bing Crosby. Now, Bing Crosby on radio was the biggest star there ever was. The Kraft Music Hall had dozens of millions of listeners weekly. And Bing Crosby made sure that some of his best jazz friends got featured on that radio show. People like Joe Venuti, for example, like Louis Armstrong, as we were just mentioning. How important was the radio, Malcolm, to the popularity of Bing Crosby pre-television?
Absolutely crucial. As you say, the audiences were vast, particularly during wartime. It's estimated that up to 50 million listened to the Kraft Music Hall at its peak. 50 million, you can't take in the figure, can you? Television really didn't make an impact till the early 50s. Before that, being on radio was very important, one of the top variety programs of all time. Kraft Music Hall was an hour, for many years, was an hour-long broadcast with people from opera and actors and other musicians, other singers and comedians. Bob Hope, of course, made his debut on the Kraft Music Hall in 1938, and one or two films resulted from that meeting. Yeah, it was absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, throughout Bing's career, how many great jazz musicians guested on his radio show, and one of my favorites among them is the great Jack Teagarden. And that's another man that, you know, we don't get to hear about very often these days, at least not often enough, in my opinion. And, you know, Teagarden made some really good records throughout his career. And he appeared, I'm not sure if it was on the Kraft Music Hall or on some other programs.
No, I don't think so. It was on Philco, I think. Philco in Chesterfield, yeah.
But he can be heard on a box set that I remember I have somewhere called Swinging with Bing, I think is the title of it. And he appears there. Ella Fitzgerald is there as well, and of course, Louis Armstrong as well. Now, by the 1950s, Malcolm Bing had, in many ways, quit not the business, but he had quit really making hit records, at least not as often as he did in the 30s and 40s. Why was that? What happened? Besides the fact that the business was changing, the music itself was changing. Did Bing become more complacent in some ways in the 50s, or did he not need to have records anymore?
Oh, well, yeah, he's a very wealthy man, and obviously he wasn't hungry, but he still he wanted success, obviously, but the musical tastes were changing. He didn't like a lot of the songs that were coming along. Where he missed out was on the albums. Sinatra was quick into the concept albums. Bing wasn't. He'd had the kind of direction that Sinatra had around that time, I think it would have made a huge impact on him. But certainly, he was busy doing other things. He had a young family giving him a few problems along the way. he got married. He lost his wife. He got married again. He had some ill health. Lots of factors, really. But the very revealing letter he wrote to John Scott Trotter in 1954, his musical director, just saying that he really has lost the urge somehow. He feels apathetic, is what he felt. And he was like that for a few years, I felt. But high society kicked him back into life, I felt. And he made a wonderful album. Well, he made a couple of good albums around that time. One with Buddy Bregman, Bing Sings Whilst Bregman Swings, which was very much up to date and packed with new arrangements. And then he went back to his roots with one of my favourite albums, Bing with a Beat.
Yes, and in fact, Malcolm, those were two albums that I would like to. I wanted to concentrate on a little bit if you have some time, because. You know, many times people ask me, well, not many times, but sometimes people ask me, you know, what is a very good album by Bing Crosby to listen to? And I get asked this by people who like jazz. So, of course, it's not going to be a Christmas album. You know, it's not going to be a ballad album or a compilation of his big hits, you know, from the 30s or 40s. But I always get to recommending that second album you mentioned, Bing with a Beat, with Bob Scobie's Frisco Jazz Band. That album is absolutely marvelous, and I have it in my car, and I listen to it all the time. And really, this is an album that Bing Crosby made after he became a freelance recording artist, if I'm not mistaken, right? Because at some point in the mid-50s, he quit Decca. He didn't renew his contract, I guess. And he became a freelance singer. And so for the first time, he could really do exactly what he wanted. And one of the things, and it's pretty telling, I think, that two things that he did almost right away was recording that album with Buddy Bregman, and then this other one with Bob Scobie. If you would like, maybe we could start talking about the album with Buddy Bregman, which I think comes before Bing with a Beat, right?
Yeah. June 56, yeah, you're right.
So Bing sings whilst Bregman swings. What was the concept behind this album, which is all too short, I think?
Buddy Bregman was quite friendly with Bing and the Crosby family, very friendly with Gary Crosby, actually. And he nagged Bing to do it and put together arrangements. And also, Buddy was a bit shocked because Bing liked to record at 9 o'clock in the morning, whereas the musicians had only probably got back from their evening engagement about that time. So anyway, they did it. It was all recorded in two mornings, different arrangements. It wasn't. There was a kind of mixed reaction when it first came out amongst the Crosby fans, because some of the backing was a bit unusual for Bing.
Mm-hmm.
Bing was almost having to sing very loudly to overcome the backing. But there's some great songs in there.
Was the intention, Malcolm, you think, trying to update Bing Crosby's sound, bearing in mind the Sinatra, Riddle, Nelson Riddle collaborations that had been so popular, like Songs for Swinging Lovers and later Swinging Affair and many others?
That's right, yeah, that was very much the idea. Because Buddy Bregman around that time was a young man, full of go and making wonderful records with Ella Fitzgerald and so on. So it was very good. Didn't quite come out in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like many albums, it's probably, I love half of the songs and I'm ambivalent about the other half. But The Song Is You, September Rain, wonderful songs.
The Song Is You is actually the album opener, if I'm not mistaken, and it's really, it really kind of sets the pace for the rest of the album. We're going to hear some brassy arrangements here, and I think this is what a lot of the Crosby fans have objected to. The ones that don't like this album so much is the fact that this is a really brassy album. It's not as relaxed as other Bing albums. But I think, in my opinion, from my perspective, that is an asset to the album. I like to hear Bing swinging once in a while, because he certainly could do it. And if you listen to the arrangements in many of the songs, the brassiness, you know, of the brass doesn't quite get in the way of Bing Crosby's voice. And the song Is You, for example, that's a good example. I really don't feel like his voice gets drowned out by the arrangement. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that, but there are other songs where maybe that is true, but in that one in particular that opens the album, I don't hear that.
Interesting you say opens the album. In the late 1950s, when I was buying these things, I couldn't afford the album. You had to buy them as EPs, and it came out as three EPs. And I only could afford, I bought one, and then a few months later I bought the other one. I never got the third EP.
So you didn't hear the whole thing.
So I had to wait for some years before I heard the whole lot.
And it's got 12 songs, and some of them, you know, you would expect. You know, Cheek to Cheek, I think, is in there. The Song Is You, as we mentioned.
Mountain Greenery.
Mountain Greenery, which is a great lyric, one that I've always liked by Lawrence Hart, right? I believe he wrote that with Richard Rodgers. Now, there's some other songs that are not quite as well known. One of them is I've Got $5.
Yes,
that's right. But that is not one of the songs that you would think, well, for sure he's going to record that. And I think, in a way, this even mirrors the Sinatra approach to making concept albums, because Sinatra very often would rescue songs that were not as well known, like Swinging Down the Lane, for example, on Songs for Swinging Lovers. So, you know, it is a fun record to hear, this collaboration with Buddy Bregman, not just because of the arrangements, but also because of some of the song choices, which I think are really interesting, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Now, the other album that we were mentioning from the 1950s, Malcolm, is the collaboration with Bob Scobie, who was an important figure in the Dixieland revival of the 1950s, although he's probably not as very well known these days. I know Jasmine Records put out a few compilations of his stuff without Bing that I have and that I enjoy listening to on a regular basis. But this album, to me, I don't know if it's the best album Bing ever made, because that's hard to say, but definitely it's right up there with the best albums that Bing ever recorded, and that's called Bing with a Beat. What do you think the concept was behind this collaboration with Scobie?
I think Bing wanted to do it. He wanted to sing some jazz in a relaxed way, and you can tell he's relaxed. Some of the ad libs and the way he's swinging, he's loving every moment of it. It was recorded just in 2 days, in two 4-hour sessions. It's incredible, really. Absolutely magnificent.
And I think there's some great musicians there. Matty Malnick, I think, is playing, and I believe. And Bob Scobie does a great job on trumpet, right?
Sutton on piano. Ralph Sutton on piano, a well-known jazz pianist. And we've just come across some letters that Bing wrote to Ralph Sutton 2 or 3 years later after that, saying how much he enjoyed that and wanting to make an album with Ralph Sutton. Jazz-oriented album with Ralph Sutton.
That would have been nice.
Never came off, unfortunately.
Sort of like the... it would have been nice to pair the two of them up the way Bill Evans and Tony Bennett did in the 1970s. That would have been a great album. Too bad that never came to fruition, right? But this collaboration with Bob Scobie, when you were mentioning that he was ad-libbing and he seemed to be having a great time... he definitely seems to, you know, when I remember, since this is one that I have in my car and I listen to very often, when they do Dream a Little Dream of Me, which is a beautiful song, any way you look at it, the version that they do together here has a pretty impressive trumpet solo by Scobie, and Bing Crosby says at some point, ad lib something like, "You ain't just dreaming, you is awake," or something like that. So he's definitely enjoying his time with the Dixieland Band. Would you say, Malcolm, that when it comes to jazz music, what was closest to Bing's heart was Dixieland jazz?
Yes, I would, undoubtedly. One thing that might have influenced that album, Bing with the Beat, was about a year before he got Buddy Cole to augment his little group with some jazz musicians, and they made, I don't know, about 10 great tracks which were just used on his radio show, but they're really very good. In fact, I think they're on a CD now called Bing in Dixieland, which Bing Crosby Enterprises mm-hmm. put out mm-hmm. A year or two back. That Bing might have just thought, yeah, I'd like to do more of this. Let's do a commercial album, and it was great.
That was another collaboration, Malcolm, that I wanted to touch upon briefly, is Bing Crosby's radio shows that he did accompanied by the great and not very well known again these days, Mr. Buddy Cole, who was a really good pianist and not a bad organist as well, even though, you know, there's some dispute as to whether the organ sounds just as good or not in the 1950s as it would later on in the 60s with the appearance of jazz greats like Jimmy Smith and the like. What do you think about those recordings that Bing did for his radio show with Buddy Cole? They have been reissued on a Mosaic 7-CD box set that as soon as it came out, I asked Santa to bring a few years ago. And he listened to me and he brought that great box set that, you know, it's a little pricey, but it is really well worth the money. What do you think about those records, those radio shows?
It's a wonderful set, brilliantly put together, and the quality is excellent, and Bing sings all kinds of songs in there. I'm not keen on the Buddy Cole organ. Uh-huh. There's one or two tracks, and when the organ comes in, I think, oh, I wish you hadn't. And Ken Barnes put some of those tracks out back in the late 70s, early 80s, and he used violins to mute the organ. And I think that worked at the time. But they're great. Being knocked off 10, 15, 20 songs in a day in those little sessions, just head arrangements, nothing really planned, and absolutely superb.
Now, this was a daily show, right?
Yeah, five nights a week, yeah.
And it was basically like 15 minutes maybe, or 20 minutes, or not a very long show.
No, 15 minutes. Started in November 54, ran until the end of December 56. Bing would have a chat for about 3 minutes in the middle of it, about something of interest to him at the time. I've personally felt that slowed the program. They're not great to listen to now because the things aren't topical anymore.
Yeah.
And I'd rather just have had the music. But it's a very interesting show. There are 550 of them altogether, spread over the 2 years or so. And it was on every night, 9:15, nationwide. But of course, it was up against television. And whilst it was fairly high up on the list of radio programmes, of course, there was nothing comparable to the television programmes of the day.
Yeah, but, again, it definitely did not kill the radio right away, because Bing Crosby was still making radio shows, which were fairly popular. Now, some of these shows are available on the Bing Crosby Internet Radio, on the BingCrosby.com website, I believe. And you're right, you know, the topical issues, while they may not be as interesting, what I like about listening to those complete shows is the chance to hear Bing Crosby's spoken voice, which I think was just absolutely marvelous. He was not just a great singer, but he was a great conversationalist as well. I remember one of my good friends who lives in Nashville and works at the library at Vanderbilt University, where I got my PhD from, and he has a Jump Blues radio show in Nashville. Mr. Pete Wilson told me one time that he always thought of Al Jolson as an orator and Bing Crosby as a conversationalist. And I think when you hear Bing Crosby talk, you have to agree with Pete when he says that. One of the things... Yes?
Sorry, Bing is so fluent when he talks. He's talking live and there's no errs. He's thought out the words. He uses a wide vocabulary. He enjoyed finding different words. He really got something there. Listen to those Kraft music halls, which were all live. His links and his chat, it's absolutely superb.
And on these shows with Buddy Cole, he actually did get to revive some really old songs that he liked, and he got to sing some of the newer songs as well in very stripped-down settings. And for those of us who like Bing Crosby, the jazz singer, and Bing Crosby, the intimate singer, for those of us who really like songs like It's Been a Long, Long Time with... you know, just the Les Paul trio, right? That is really a treat to get to hear Bing Crosby in a small group setting, because I feel like Bing did not make a lot of commercial recordings in a small group setting.
No, he didn't. I mean, most of his recordings were with a big orchestra, John Scott Trotter, 22 orchestra, men in the orchestra, whatever it was. You're right. Absolutely right. Buddy Cole just had his trio with it. Except that time he added the jazz musicians, of course.
And it was a very good trio as well, you know, with some nice guitar and, you know, the arrangements, you know, they were pretty, you know, straight-ahead arrangements, but they suited Bing's voice pretty well.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Jazz Flashes podcast. Anton Garcia Fernandez talking to you here from North Carolina, and over in the UK, Mr. Malcolm McFarlane, who's... taking a little time to sit down and chat with us, thanks to the wonders of modern-day technology. We've already talked a little bit, although briefly, about that Satchmo and Bing album, which that one was another one of Bing Crosby's freelance projects, right? He made quite a few of those. Do you have any idea if they actually were in the studio together or not?
No, it's controversial. Some people who were there say they were, but just the sound of it doesn't sound as though they were somehow. So I need to be convinced. Billy Mayhew said they were there, but there you go.
I've always wished that they had gone for more jazz stuff on that album, for more jazz material, because you have somebody who's a great arranger like Billy May, and a very modern one with those slurping saxes and everything, right? And he made some great records with Nat King Cole, right, and Sinatra. But then I feel like that album, and I have it and I listen to it regularly, but I feel like it's a missed opportunity for Bing Crosby and Satchmo to really make some real magic happen.
You're right. Again, it's I love four of the tracks. Ambivalent about four. Not too bothered about the other four. You know.
My favorite on there is Sugar. That Sugar Baby of Mine. And that song, every time I think of that song, I think of Lee Wiley again, because she had a beautiful version of that back in the day, I believe in the 1940s. And that's the first time I ever heard that song, was by the great Lee Wiley. And Bing and Satchmo do a fun version of it. It's a little scripted, you know, because there's new lyrics to it, some special material there. But that one, if I had to choose one song from that album, that would be the one.
Yeah, I like Rocky Mountain Moon.
That one's good, too.
hardly a jazz song, but I just like the song, the way Bing sings it. The Preacher, Brother Bill, some nice songs on it.
And that opens the 1960s for Bing, right? Because that was recorded in the year 1960, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right.
And the 60s would see a decrease in Bing Crosby's activities, at least on record, right? But it was also the decade that had Bing Crosby and Count Basie together. For one,
that was 72, I think.
It was in the 70s? Okay. It was not in the 60s then. For some reason, I always thought it was the 60s. So if it was 1972, we're moving ahead to the 70s. And to me, Malcolm, I was trying to do a segue there into that album, and I just messed it up. But in any case, I think, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think that's another missed opportunity there for Bing Crosby to do a really great album with a classic, a legend of American music, Mr. William Basie. Especially bearing in mind the great record Sinatra did with Basie, and you know the live recordings that Sinatra also did with him in Las Vegas and the TV shows. I wonder what happened there. That was a no-brainer. You have a great band, you have a great singer, and somehow it just doesn't quite click.
Well, the tracks were recorded separately to the singing. I think about 3 weeks before, Basie laid down the tracks, then Bing went into the studio and sang to the playback. And you're never going to get the same emotion, the same enthusiasm, are you, somehow? They're competent. It's competent, but it just lacks excitement, doesn't it?
It does. And I think in another problem that I see with the album is some of the song choices. I believe one of the songs is General on My Mind, which is by John Hartford, and you know was a big country record for Glen Campbell, and then several pop singers, among them Dean Martin, had it out as well. I'm not sure why, when you have a giant of jazz like Count Basie and a great singer that can do almost anything, but definitely jazz, you wouldn't go for something a little bit more, a little jazzier, right? So I think you're right. The fact that they were not in the studio together, that the tracks were laid down first and then Bing Crosby sang over the recordings, that doesn't help. But then some of the tracks, is Little Green Apples on there as well?
Yes.
So I'm not sure what the concept was. Maybe they were trying to get a hit out of that.
Yeah, he'd done Little Green Apples 3 years before on the Hey Jude album, so it was surprising that he decided to do it again. It is quite a different version, mind you. And Bing's voice is okay, but he's not. It's not at his best, his voice. He wasn't singing so frequently then. And it was not until 1975 when he started making albums with Ken Barnes.
Ken Barnes.
And then went giving out concert performances at the Palladium and so on. That's when his voice came back again. He used to say, vocal cords are a muscle. If you don't use them, you lose them.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't. He said, I can go months without singing at all. And I think it showed on that album.
I agree. I think so.
Not to denigrate it completely. I like a lot of the tracks on it, but it wasn't as good as it should have been.
And that's one that has been reissued on CD, so I have both the old vinyl and the CD version of it, although I think it's out of print.
Well, it's a long time. It must be 20 years, more than 20 years. On CD, so it's probably due for a reissue. Perhaps Bing Crosby Enterprises will put it out shortly.
Now, one of Bing Crosby's best friends was Rosemary Clooney, and they made some record projects together in the late 50s and in the early 60s. I'm thinking of two albums in particular, Fancy Meeting You Here and that Traveling Two beat. What do you think about? Well, they also recorded radio shows together, which are also a lot of fun to listen to. What do you think about the collaborations between Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney? They were also together in movies, of course.
Yeah, I think they're great collaborations. They sang so easily together. They knew what the other one was going to do. They understood each other. It was a wonderful partnership. The two albums, Fancy Meeting You Here, wonderful album, absolutely brilliant. One of the outstanding albums of the 50s, I would have thought. And the second one they made in 1964, that Travelling Two beat, which people said, oh, it's not as good as Fancy Meeting You Here. But I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's jazz backing and updated lyrics. Again, they weren't in the studio at the same time for some of the tracks, mm-hmm. which spoils it a little bit. But it's still very good.
I think those two albums could be reissued on just one CD, and they would go together really well. They have not been reissued that way, maybe for reasons of copyright or whatever it is. But I think the two of them are very good in the way that the Traveling Two beat to me sounds like Fancy Meeting You Here Two, right? Like there's duets one, duets two for Frank Sinatra, right? This could really fit that description, and they're only recorded about what maybe 7 years apart or so.
Six years apart.
So yeah, and I think the arrangements are just fantastic. In fact, I think that album, the second one, that Traveling Two beat, has been reissued together with a country album. By Collector's Choice Music, I think. I tend to listen to the Rosemary Clooney, Bing Crosby side of that and not so much to the country album that Bing did, trying to sound like a Nashville sound singer in the way of Dean Martin in those years of the mid-1960s. But the reason why I was asking you about Bing and Rosemary Clooney, of course, is because you have written or co-written that wonderful book, Late Life Jazz, that I recommend to everybody out there, because I've listened to it, I've read it, I've listened to the songs as I was reading the book, which is, I think, a very good way to do that. And it really is a thorough book. It's well written and incredibly informative. So I must commend you on a job well done with that book, Late Life Jazz.
Many thanks for that. We enjoyed doing it. A lot of interesting people we met along the way interviewing them, which is always fascinating.
Malcolm, when we think about Bing Crosby in the 1970s, right, I feel like, it's obvious that there is a sort of comeback there at the very end of his career that some people like to call the late Crosby period, right? And there's always discussions as to whether the late Crosby period is better than others and this and that. We're not going to get into that because, I like pretty much all the different periods of Bing Crosby's career. I am a little bit more partial, I guess, to the 30s and 40s just because that's when I first heard the music of Bing Crosby. Those early records were the first ones I heard. But I love everything else he did in the 50s and even in the 60s. And then in the 70s, he made some great albums. Now, Bing Crosby was very much attached to the British Isles. He really enjoyed spending time in the United Kingdom, and I think that goes back to World War II years. Why do you think Bing Crosby was so attached to your country?
Well, he used to list the people, the races, the pubs, you know. I think he probably felt more relaxed here. It wasn't the same kind of intensity. We more kind of let him get on with it, you know. He was very loyal to us. He always spoke well of us. He also spoke well of France. He spent a lot of time in France. Mm-hmm. But I think London was one of his favourite cities, mm-hmm. because there were so many things, the golf, the racing and so on. After all, he spent about 3 months here in 1961 making the film The Road to Hong Kong. As you say, he came over in 1944 and performed all over the country, to the American forces. My great memory of Bing in the UK is, of course, his Palladium show.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a little personal story about that, in that it was announced in the papers about March 1976 that he was coming across in June 76. And I said, well, I'll have to go. I'd always promised myself that whenever Bing Crosby came to the UK, I'd go and see him. There was a slight complication, though. My wife was pregnant with twins.
Oh.
So she said, oh, you better go on your own. Now, we lived in Nottingham, which is 2 hours away from London.
Mm-hmm.
Twins being twins, they came early. So I took 2 weeks off to be at home, sort things out. My first day back at work in Nottingham was the day of Bing's opening night at the Palladium. And I got a ticket. So I went into work that day, and everyone was fussing around me about the twins. And I said, would you mind if I leave a little early tonight? And they assumed, of course, I was racing home to be with my wife and the twins. But no. They said, yo, go ahead. But I raced down to the station, jumped on the train to the Palladium, the steeping. And it was a revelation, really. I mean, Bing had been on television, and he came across as a bit of an old man, a bit lackluster, but very pleasant. But that opening Palladium concert was absolutely tremendous. The power of his voice surprised me. And we had a freak heat wave around that time, about 90 degrees the temperature. He was on stage for 2.5 hours.
Wow.
It was a very clever opening. There was a lot of atmosphere in the theatre beforehand. Bing Crosby's got to come. Bing, you know, everyone's like that. And the curtains draw back, and there's a cinema screen there. And they start to show a newsreel from 1944, the opening of a Forces Club, when Bing's there. And Bing appears on the picture screen. Everybody claps that, and he sings San Fernando Valley. And then everybody applauds that. The screen lifts, and then Bing Crosby comes onto the stage, the spotlight's on him. I have to tell you, it was one of those moments when the hair on the back of your neck went up, you know. And it was tremendous. You know, he sang all kinds of songs, an incredible medley of his hits, and then a song called That's What Life Is All About, mm-hmm. which he really belted out. It was magical. And I became even more converted, and even joined the fan club at that stage.
Well, that was a United Artists song, a recording. That's What Life Is All About, meant to be a sort of My Way, you know, for Bing Crosby,
yeah.
Right? It's a great song, really. I really like it. And as I also like the albums that he made in England in the 1970s. Now, the Palladium was, you know, the big monument of British entertainment. That place was pretty much everyone who was anybody throughout the decades sang at the Palladium on Sunday night, right? Including the Beatles and, you know, older acts. Like, one of my favorite acts, believe it or not, is George Formby. I've always liked the music of George Formby.
Oh, yeah, I like George Formby.
But
you understand the humor of George Formby?
Well, a lot of it is probably lost, not necessarily in translation, but in the fact that it was probably very very close to the British experience, right? But I've always liked his music. I must admit, I have those JSP box sets that have pretty much everything that he ever recorded, and it's amazing how popular he was, and also how much he influenced some of the British rock and roll acts that came in the 1960s. They all have a version of Auntie Maggie's Remedy or some song like that by George Formby. But I really wish I could have been at the Palladium there with you, because that must have been amazing. For those of us who were not there, I have a CD that includes one of those performances. And I think those Palladium concerts were very well put together. The concept behind them was very interesting. And they were quite jazzy in many ways. There were some, he was accompanied by some jazz musicians on that. Tour.
Well, yeah. Joe Bushkin and his trio and his group, and they did a very nice version of Now He Has Jazz, and then let Joe Bushkin play a couple of songs himself. Yeah, that was good.
Joe Bushkin, who wrote Look at Me Now, I believe, and I think he did, and he used to play with Tommy Dorsey back in the day. He was
yes,
one
he
of
did.
one of Dorsey's go-to piano players. But what I like is this medley that Bing Crosby did that lasted forever, where you get an idea of what a wide range of hits Bing Crosby had throughout his career. Because he could keep singing more and more, and he just sings a few bars of each song, but it's song after song that's a classic, you know, of 20th century pop music. And, you know, all of those songs had Bing's name all over them. So it's really recommendable.
Medley the First Night was slightly longer. But what you hear on the record, which was done a couple of days later, is what happened the night I was there. He sings the intro to Pennies from Heaven. Not everybody knows the verse to Pennies from Heaven. And then, of course, when he goes into the chorus, every time it rained, the whole theatre joined in. And Bing loved it. He loved it, everyone joining in and singing along with him. And I don't think it happened to him very often, but he encouraged it from then on. The rest of the 2 weeks he was there.
I like the fact that Bing Crosby enjoyed singing the verses to the songs, because when you know, after the swing era, all of those were wiped out. And many times they had a lot to do with the song. It kind of led up to the song in a meaningful way. And I think in the case of Pennies from Heaven, you know, a long time ago, a million years BC and so on, that kind of gives you an idea of why the song is called Pennies from Heaven, in very much the same way that we know why Bing Crosby is dreaming of a white Christmas instead of having a white Christmas. If we're at Christmas and we listen to him singing I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, I've always wondered, before I heard the verse, why is he dreaming of a white Christmas when it's snowing outside? And then you realize that the song is about somebody in Los Angeles where it hardly, if ever, snows, and he's dreaming of having a white... So it makes a lot of sense once you know that. To kind of wind down the conversation, Malcolm, because I know you probably have other things to do that keep I don't want to keep you here for hours, although it's really interesting for me to chat with you about Bing and jazz and all different kinds of things. When Bing Crosby in the 1970s not that he revived his career, but he came back into the studio and made a series of albums. I must say that most of those albums are really not very jazzy. They're more pop, right, than they are jazz. But that is a very important body of work in Bing Crosby's career towards the very end of his life. If you had to choose one album among the ones he made in the 70s, would you be able to choose one, or would you just want to briefly discuss all of them?
Wow. He made about half a dozen albums with Ken Barnes, but he also made one for Decca. Mm-hmm. Feels Good, Feels Right.
And that's the one I haven't heard. I've never heard that album, I admit.
Well, if you really pushed me, I think I'd go for Feels Good, Feels Right. Ken Barnes, if he was still here, would slaughter me because he didn't like the album, I don't think. But nice mixture of songs, nice backing, and brings in good voice. It's a record you ought to hear.
Now, he does. He did one called The Southern Memoir, right, if I'm not mistaken, is that?
Yeah.
Now, that one is in many ways a concept album, right? I like the song choices, and for the most part, the arrangements are very good. But there's a song in there, his version of Georgia on My Mind, that has always blown my mind in many ways, because it has a certain kind of disco-ish, funky-ish beat that is so very much unlike Bing, but he somehow makes it work the way he sings the song.
Well, I'm in the minority. I love it. Most Crosby fans are appalled by it, but I love it. I think it's great, full of life and pep and excellent.
What do you think about the collaboration, late Crosby collaboration with the great Fred Astaire, who's another one of my favorite singers of all time? And I don't think that Fred Astaire gets as much credit as he should for being a great jazz singer.
No, you're right. I don't know if you heard the album 1952 album. It was called probably the Fred Astaire story.
The Astaire story with Oscar Peterson, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely superb versions of all these great songs, but sung with almost a jazz backing, small group backing.
You have Ray Brown, I think, and Ed Thigpen is on drums. Charlie Shavers, I think, plays the trumpet on some of the songs. There's a saxophone in there. I think it's Flip Phillips. That is an outstanding album. And in many ways, Malcolm, I wish that Bing Crosby had done that, that he had had a chance to collaborate with Oscar Peterson. There is that musical autobiography, which is interesting, but then again, it's another collaboration with Buddy Cole. But I think if Bing had had the chance to record a whole project with Norman Granz producing and Oscar Peterson on the trio or quartet, that would have been, you know, many times I wonder how magnificent that would be. But they did, Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire, they, of course, made movies together. They were good friends. And then in the 70s, they recorded an album together. A couple of Song and Dance Men, I think it was called.
Yes.
Have you heard that album lately?
Not lately, no. But it's one I know pretty well. It's a very amusing album. Fred Astaire was bothered about Bing's ad-libs because he wouldn't be able to keep up with him, so he got Kent Barnes to write him some ad-libs.
There's the contradiction right there. You got to write some ad-libs.
Huh? That's right, yeah. So that Fred was prepared. But it's a very nice album, very pleasant. Neither of them at the best, obviously. They're both in the 70s. And a nice version of Couple and Song and Dance Man, the song they did back in 1946, that's a nice version. And nice Bing solo on Changing Partners, I think it is.
I always have this conversation with my wife, who is my age, of course, and, you know, like me, never got a chance to see Bing live in any way. But we both really enjoy old movies, and we always have this big controversy about whether, you know, Fred Astaire or Bing Crosby is more likable in the movie. She says that it's Fred, and I say that it's Bing. But in any case, as a musician, I think Fred Astaire was simply a fantastic singer, and you know, it's no wonder that so many great songwriters like Cole Porter and the Gershwins and, you know, so many of them wrote songs specifically for him that were introduced by Fred Astaire. And in many ways, even now, after so many years, some of the definitive versions of those songs are the original Astaire recordings, in my opinion. They're really jazzy and very likable and show his personality very well.
Yeah, oh yeah, I agree, absolutely. I love those old Fred Astaire films from the 30s.
Like Top Hat and Flying Down to Rio.
He introduced some great songs, and his dancing, of course, is fantastic. I've never seen anything like it before or since.
And I don't think that his dancing would have been possible without jazz in many ways.
No, perhaps you're right.
It was a very, very jazzy kind of, tab dancing, and, you know, it all comes out of the same tradition. You're listening Sorry?
Fred was a good jazz pianist, too.
Oh, yeah. In fact, in some of those and some of those recordings for the Fred Astaire story, you can hear him playing piano.
Yes.
There's some songs in which he actually plays piano, and Oscar Peterson, no less, steps aside to let him handle the keyboard in those ones. Well, you're listening to the Jazz Flashes podcast, and we're about to finish now our conversation with Malcolm McFarlane over in England. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and I want to simply touch upon the very last album that Bing Crosby ever recorded. Since, you know, the jazz thread kind of evolved into something much bigger, because we're talking about Bing Crosby, and it's kind of hard to just concentrate on one aspect of his career. The last album that he made was, yet again, a concept album, right?
Seasons.
And it was called Seasons. And this has been done before, the concept of, you know, songs about the seasons or songs about different parts of the year, like Calendar Girl by Julie London, for example, and, you know, several others along those lines. That is, in my opinion, one of the best albums that Bing Crosby did in the 1970s, Seasons. And I think I've read some of the letters that he wrote back and forth with Ken Barnes, and he had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do with that album. What do you think on the whole about the finished product that came out of those sessions that yielded that Seasons, which is the last album Bing ever recorded?
Bing's voice had a certain vulnerability about it on that album, I thought. He'd had to fall off the stage and was in a lot of pain with his back. He was coming across to do the Palladium shows. He hadn't been singing for a while. There's a certain vulnerability, but when he sings the title song, mm-hmm. I find that very moving, a very moving version. It's one of your favorite, you say?
It really is. I really like the concept to begin with. I think the songs are very well chosen. And I think the vulnerability that you're talking about in Bing's voice is definitely there. But I think that adds to the finished product in that it is the last testament of his recorded career, in a way. Of course, he didn't know that when he was recording it, but I think it's a very fitting finale for Bing Crosby. I've always thought it was a very fitting finale for Bing Crosby's career. A concept album that is really well thought out and planned out with songs carefully chosen, good arrangements. And then, although his voice, you know, was a little different, as you say, and it has to do with events that happened in his life immediately prior to his recording that album, I've always really liked listening to it, and I keep coming back to it.
Yesterday, when I was young, again, very moving version, and the words mean so much when you hear him sing that. Sleigh Ride, I'm not too bothered about that. Nice version of June in January.
Yes.
On there. Yeah.
That one is a song that I've always liked, and he actually sang it a long time before that.
Yeah. Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year. That's a lovely version, too. Yes, good stuff there.
It really is. Well, Malcolm, before we finish, I would like to simply remind the audience of those about those three books that you wrote or co-wrote. I would also like to mention something about the International Club Crosby that we both belong to and that we both co-work on putting together the Bing magazine that is sent out to the members, although I must admit that this latest issue, you basically did all the work, and I must apologize for that, but it really won't happen again. I promise I'll do my best so that it won't happen again. Now, the three books that you wrote are, first of all, I'm not necessarily in chronological order, but you did write a biography of Perry Como.
Yes.
Were you trying to, since that's the one I haven't read, were you trying to just to concentrate on his music the way you did with Rosemary Clooney on that one?
Well, and his life as well. I mean, Ken Crossland and I, who I wrote the book with, we met Perry Como in 1994. He was 82. He came across to Dublin to do his Christmas concert. This was in for television. This was in January 94, ready to go out in December 94. And through a friend of ours, George O'Reilly, we got in to the rehearsal in the afternoon and were able to have a chat with him for about 20 minutes, just eyeball to eyeball. And we were struck by what a warm and friendly man he was, who was interested in us. Eye contact, wanting to know where we were from, and we were saying, well, we're Crosby fans, really, you know. And he said, well, so am I, you know, and he told Bing, I got this style from copying you, and you know, he always gave credit to Bing. And we thought, he said, a few years went by, and he died, and we thought, nobody knows much about Perry Como, and he was a huge star in the 50s.
And even before that, in the 40s.
That's right. If you look at the Billboard charts in the 50s, the man who had the most weeks in the charts was Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
Second was Perry Como, which not a lot of people know that.
And Eddie Fisher was probably quite close behind there.
He probably was. I couldn't quite get the figures, but yeah, he was. Perry Como, the more we looked into it, we realised no one's ever written a book about Perry Como.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to basics, went back to where he was born, and I interviewed his brother, one of his sons. I had a day with one of his sons, and we put it together. And I think it's a loving tribute to a remarkable singer. Perry Como's singing, you never seem to have a bad day. Most singers have, you think, oh, wish you hadn't sung that. But Como's singing was so consistent, it really was, even till his dying day. A very nice man who deserves to be remembered. And that was one of the reasons we wrote the book.
I admit that I really love Perry Como, and I have a lot of his albums. And it's hard to find a singer that was more influenced by Bing Crosby than Perry Como, unless we think about Buddy Clark, for example, or the British Michael Holliday, who really tried to sing like Bing, and did a good job of it, too. Now, the other book that you wrote, which is a biography, is the one called Late Life Jazz, about Rosemary Clooney, which has a very strong Bing connection.
Yes.
And that one was the latest that you wrote, and it has been with Ken Crossland as well, right?
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And
yeah.
It has been released or published by Oxford University, is that right?
Yes, based in New York. I mean, they obviously have a branch in Oxford as well in the UK, but a very prestigious publisher in New York, Oxford University Press, so that we chose them.
Was this another case of writing a book that hasn't been written before?
No. And it's usually the Crosby connection that attracts us, and there's a Crosby connection with Como and very much with Clooney. Rosemary had written two autobiographies,
mm-hmm.
Mainly covering her personal life. No one, we felt, had really looked at her career.
Mm-hmm.
So we made that our priority. Three wonderful albums, great thick albums, were put out. I forgot the name of the company,
mm-hmm.
Which has got a lot of autobiography details about her career.
You mean maybe the Concord albums that she did, or no?
No. Mm-hmm. They were compilation things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Wonderful albums. I can't think of what the company was now. Oh, Bear. It's the Bear family.
Oh, Bear family. Yes, from Germany,
yeah, the
right?
The Bear family. They were wonderful. Anyway, we felt we should document her career, so we made that a priority all the way through. We've got. There's a chronology, there's a discography, there's details of her TV appearances and so on in it.
What I really like about that book is that you concentrate both on her life and also the music. And I feel like many biographies do overlook the music in many cases. Of course, not the Gary Giddens biography of Bing Crosby, which is a monument, really, and I'm hoping that the second volume will come out soon. But, for example, when you're thinking of biographies that I've read throughout the years, and one of them in particular comes to mind, which is a biography of Dick Hames. I've always liked the singer, Dick Hames, from the 1940s, and he kept going through the 50s, 60s, and 70s with many ups and downs. There's a really good biography of Dick Hames by Ruth Pregosi, who is a professor here in the United States.
Hofstra.
At Hofstra, I believe, yes.
Yes, she organized the Bing tribute in 2002.
2000, that's right, the conference, right? Now, what I like that biography because it gives you a great overview, very in-depth overview of Dick Hames's really interesting life. But there's very little in that book about his music. And what I really like or am interested in the case of these singers or songwriters or whatever it is their work. And that's why, for example, I love the book that Will Fridwell wrote about Sinatra,
yeah.
The Song Is You, because it really goes in depth into his music. And I think we should have more of that. And I think late life jazz does that.
Well, thank you.
And finally, Day by Day, this monumental Bing Crosby chronology. How did that project come about, Malcolm?
Well, a writer called Roger Osterholm had written a book about Bing, and he ran it past me. And he'd got a simple chronology at the end of it, very basic. And I thought, oh, that'll be a nice little thing I could put in the magazine and expand it a bit. So I started playing with it, and it grew like Topsy. So in the end, I did a book for the club, Bing, A Diary of a Lifetime, it was called. It was a slim volume, but we more or less gave it to every member at a bargain price. And when I retired about 4 years later, my wife said, because I spent a bit of time on Bing Crosby, said, you ought to write a book about Bing Crosby. So taking this Diary of a Lifetime, I started to expand it. And my wife's always happy to have a holiday in the States, so we went to the States, to various places where Bing had been, and I got into the libraries, dug out the old newspapers, and put it together from that. It became a fascinating hobby, and it was published in 2001 and completely sold out over the next couple of years. And then when they told me to completely sold out, I thought, well, it's a shame they didn't seem to mind. So I put it on the internet, and I update it probably two or three times a month when something new comes to light.
Yeah, there's bad news and good news about that book. The bad news is it the print version commands really high prices on Amazon and other websites. Now, the good news is you can go online to the Bing Magazine website, and you have it right there, and actually more updated version of it than the print version. I'm still a print person. I like to have the book, and I unfortunately don't have it, and I don't think I will because of the because of the high prices it commands. But in any case, it's really a very interesting book, and it helps a lot. There it is. You have it right there in front of you. I like the cover picture of Bing there with that hat, and it's really a nice volume. If you can find it for less than $100, but it hasn't been possible in the last several years to find it for less than $100.
800 pages.
But you can always go to the website, bingmagazine.co.uk, I think it is.
Yes, that's right.
And you can find all of that and more. And it really helps a lot when I'm trying to write an article for the Bing Magazine to just go in there and see what Variety said about this album or that other album, or when he made the records and with whom, and when exactly it was in the studio, and that sort of thing. So that really is a commendable job that you did in that book for everyone out there who's interested in Bing. And finally, for everyone out there who's interested in Bing, Malcolm, you and I know each other primarily or mostly because we are both co-editors of Bing Magazine. And Bing Magazine is the magazine of the International Club Crosby. So please tell the audience a little bit about this Bing Crosby worldwide club, which is, I believe, the oldest fan club in the history of the world.
It is indeed. It came together in 1936 as Club Crosby in the States, and the British side of it was called the International Crosby Circle, and that they merged with Club Crosby in 2002 to become the International Club Crosby. And we're very proud of it, really. Longest running fan club, in, as recognised by the Guinness Book of Records. We issue a magazine three times a year. Again, we think it's one of the top magazines for a fan club. It's a 56-page glossy, coloured covers and so on, high-class paper, and some wonderful articles by people such as yourself.
Well, thank you. And I have been a member for several years, and I'm now the co-editor of the magazine. And for anyone out there who might be interested in becoming a member of the ICC, International Club Crosby, if you type International Club Crosby on Google, it'll get you to the website and all the information about the fees and how to who to write, who to contact in order to become a member is there. And we're always on the lookout for new members of the club, both young and not so young. and keeping the memory of Bing Crosby alive. Who, when he was alive, Bing Crosby was pretty much quite a bit in contact with the club, right?
Always, yes. He used to drop a line to the editor. Obviously, he got a copy of the magazine, so he'd often comment on it, and he'd drop them a line just to say what he was up to, what new records he was making, and what he was planning to do. No, he was very supportive over the years. And when he was doing his records in London, he arranged for the fan club members to come in on the last day to watch some of the tracks being recorded. And when he came over to do something for the American Sportsman, a fishing exercise, he was staying at a hotel up in the Lake District. And again, he arranged for parties to come across. It was always laid on 8 o'clock, and people say they dead on 8 o'clock, Bing would be there. And one man tells the story of how, I think there were 8 of them, and Bing was introduced to them all, took in the name, and then said, "Now, what would you all like to drink?" And they all said, "Oh, I'll have a shandy, I'll have a pint." And so he went round. He remembered all this. He went across, placed the order, came back with the tray, remembered who was who and what drink. And that shows he had a remarkable memory. And then at 9 o'clock, which he said, an hour, dead on 9, "But I've got to go, I've got to make a call to Hollywood," or some such excuse. And that was it. But he gave his time very generously to the club over many years.
Well, leaving aside all the love that we feel for his figure and his work, Bing Crosby definitely was a remarkable man, not just a remarkable singer. And he is present throughout the 20th century in so many important things, important developments in the social history of the United States and the world. And it's so often so fascinating to see how many connections with Bing Crosby one can find in the most incredible things, in the most incredible ways. I just not long ago, I was talking to a very good friend of mine who is a huge David Bowie fan, and there's, of course, the David Bowie connection with Bing Crosby. And every time I go to the store and I see Minute Maid orange juice, I think of Bing Crosby. Even when I see I have family in Pittsburgh, and they're Pittsburgh Pirates fans, so there again, you have a connection with Bing, and you know, the golf connection, the fishing connection. He did so much in the span of his life in such a meaningful way, which is amazing, really.
Well, every time you watch a recorded program, Bing Crosby was behind that with the tape. Amazing.
And supposedly he did so. He funded that so that he had more time to be on the links and playing golf, right?
Yeah, he could organize his time better, and also he could put out a higher quality show. You know, if the song didn't go too well, he could do it again.
Would you say he was a perfectionist in that way when it came to his recordings, or not so much?
Well, he always used to say if it was just him, he'd just knock off a couple of songs and that's it, finished. But if he was recording with somebody else, he made sure he was dead on. And there's probably some truth in that.
Malcolm McFarlane, everybody, thank you so much, Malcolm, for being on the Jazz Flashes podcast here this morning for me and afternoon for you over there in England. I really appreciate it, and hopefully in the future we can do some more conversations like this.
That would be lovely. Plenty to talk about.
There is, really, when it comes to Bing and all the different connections that there are, and now that I know you're a George Formby fan, maybe even much more so. Well, Malcolm, thank you again, and I hope you have a great rest of the day. And keep listening to the great music of Bing Crosby, and I know you and I will keep in touch very closely in the very near future. Thanks again.
Thanks very much.
Malcolm McFarlane, everybody, this was a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast, which will be available on YouTube, also on iTunes and on Podbean very soon. And if you enjoyed this chat, well, we will have more on the way, maybe with Malcolm, maybe with other people. And you can always read all my latest jazz articles on jazzflashes.blogspot.com. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and I'm signing off now from North Carolina in the United States of America.